There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile on this Tuesday, and a lot to do this hour. At kind of the pacing I saw from the last couple of hours, not to worry. The continued questions back and forth with the House Judiciary Committee questioning Attorney General William Barr will probably be going on when you put the kids to sleep tonight. It's like it's going on and on and on and on. But I talked about this hour. This is a neat opportunity, and I have some people that have been texting in some questions as well. I'd like to welcome to the show. And I don't believe, maybe in the past in 2016, but Katrina Pierce, Senior Advisor for President Trump's campaign, is joining us now on Midday Mobile. Thanks for your time. I don't know if you were on the show back in 2016 or not. It's kind of a blur back then. I'm sure it's beyond a blur for you as well.
We've all slept since then, but I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for coming on. And I do want to talk. I got a whole list of things here I want to get into as we are, 90-something days? Y'all aren't counting there, are you? 90-something days away from Election Day?
98 days now.
So there is the big calendar. You put the X through it there as you count down the days here. And let's talk about this, what President Trump is facing, whether it's a question about the economy, a question about coronavirus. It seems like third or fourth on the list is the actual Democrat nominee Joe Biden, but he's rolling out his Build Back Better economic plan out there. Let's talk about this and talk about this, what y'all believe this means for the economy compared to President Trump's plan.
Yeah, you know, it really depends on where you are as to what's most important for you. If you're in a blue run area, you're more concerned about coronavirus, obviously, and you're probably more concerned about law and order. But the economic plan that Joe Biden pushed out, I think, is quite interesting for a couple of reasons. The first one being that he actually plagiarized the Trump campaign and the Trump agenda of America First. So that is my first little caveat with this plan. And the other is, you have a candidate on the Democrat side who has been in office for nearly 50 years and is still complaining about all of the things that he should have been fixing along the way, whereas you have President Trump, who has a record over the last 4 years of delivering promise after promise to the American people, whether it be jobs in the economy, whether it be the outlook in the future, whether it be renegotiating trade, and actually addressing all of the issues that many disenfranchised Americans are complaining about today. President Trump has been righting the wrongs of Joe Biden.
And Katrina, you make a statement there that I think comes down to just regular municipal politics. It's that member of a city council or whatever the local government is in a place that is complaining about the litter or the stagnant water in the ditches or the road that doesn't get repaved, but they've been in that position for decades. And you ask, okay, if it's still a problem, aren't you the problem after all this time?
Well, absolutely, and we're seeing this across the board with many of these cases, particularly what we're seeing with civil unrest. You have these mayors, primarily in Democrat-run cities, who have essentially done nothing, and they're pointing the finger at President Trump, and it's just a lot of people are looking at the irony of all the complaints by people on the left, by the voters on the left, and how at the same time the left has actually been in charge, if not the author of and implementators of the policies that they're complaining about today. So we're just excited to be, almost 100 days out and being able to take the president's accomplishment directly to the American people, because we know the mainstream media is not going to tell the country everything that our president has done. So we're excited to be out there doing just that.
You know, we talk about the blue states or blue cities and the civil unrest going on there. I'll call it what it is. I mean, there's protesting, which makes me happy to see people exercise their First Amendment rights. There is rioting and looting and violence that is I don't think in the minds of very many Americans is something that they want to cheer. And so if that leadership in those blue cities are holding their finger to the wind to try to check the, you know, the wind here and say, okay, I'm going to call out police, defund police, I'm going to stand with these people that are agitators here, they're not hearing from the break. I think even in blue cities, Katrina, that folks that are trying to run business, I don't care what letter is behind how they vote, it's R or D or I or whatever it is, they want security for their families, they want security for their businesses, the places they work, their churches. I think at that point, law and order, it supersedes anybody's political bent.
Oh, well, you're absolutely right. You know, and as one of the original founders of the Tea Party movement, I wholeheartedly embrace and support peaceful assembly and protest through and through. What we're seeing today is outright crime. These are criminals who are out there destroying property, assaulting people, terrorizing neighborhoods. So you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter how you vote. Safety is the one thing that should be guaranteed in this country. It's the reason why people risk their lives and leave everything they've ever known to come to our country, because you're supposed to be able to have your own thoughts and have your own beliefs without being persecuted for them. So this is the issue that does cross party lines. It crosses race. It crosses gender. And a lot of people are looking at their leaders wondering why they're not doing anything, and seeing President Trump doing what he can do in his capacity to try to protect the citizens in those cities.
Katrina, and if you're just joining us, talking to Katrina Pearson, senior advisor for the Trump campaign, it is just strategically looking at the other side. If I was the Democrats, I would be playing maybe a different version of a discussion of security. I would say, well, President Trump's not doing it correctly. We're going to keep you safe as well, and here's how we're going to do it. But it's not even that. It's the answer to that is defund the police. It's not even the Democrats offering a different version of it. It's an aversion to it.
Well, it sounds like you are a rational man, and I think you have to suspend all logic and reason to understand why they would go further left to the extreme radical side of this. But this is what Trump derangement syndrome is. I mean, you have a group of people who are so far radical, they're going to take this opportunity to try and destroy our country, and in the process, turn citizens against President Trump, and it's just not going to happen. To your point, it's irrational to think that we should be talking about, you know, defunding the police. This is essential to having a civil society. And I think that's why you're seeing more and more people, you know, take to social media, go out there and speak their mind and share their voices about ending this, you know, insanity and backing President Trump.
Let's talk about momentum. Old Uncle Mo here, and I'm looking at a text line question here. It says, as a Trump supporter, I am truly concerned. It does appear that the president's campaign has lost momentum. Is this actually the case, or is this the result of a manipulated media coverage?
Look, this is absolutely manipulation by the media, whether it be the fake polls or just not covering the president. You know, one of the things I explained in 2016 is, you know, if you had five people attacking the president on CNN, I would be the one person sitting there defending him. You don't even see that today. There's not a single person that provides the alternative to what you're hearing in the press. Secondly, they don't even cover the president's speeches. When George Floyd occurred, the president gave a thoughtful, heartfelt speech when he was out at NASA, and the press refused to cover the speech and instead told all of America that he hasn't said anything. And so we're dealing with a massive manipulative media, but we are on the road. Pretty soon, you guys are going to see a gigantic pink-wrapped Women for Trump bus in your city, because we're going directly to the voters.
Well, that's one of the areas I know in the discussion this morning on the show that it came up that somebody was suggesting that one of the areas of trouble for President Trump was suburban women or women here. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe we haven't heard from the women. What do y'all hear at the campaign from women?
You know, this is like Groundhog's Day for us. They said the exact same thing in 2016. And they pointed to suburban white women, and they pointed to all the polls. And what we found as Women for Trump on the last bus tour is that tons of women supported the president. We would have Democrat women come out to these events and tell us how important it was that Hillary Clinton not be elected. And we're seeing that now. We've been to Wisconsin. We've been to Maine. We've been to New Hampshire. We are now going to go all across the country again, and I guarantee you we're going to see the exact same thing, because guess what? White suburban women love their children. They love their families. They love their husbands, all of which are under attack if Joe Biden is elected. So we're going to get out there. We're going to talk to those women. And come November, all of America will make a choice. Do we vote for President Trump, a candidate who keeps his promises and makes America great, or Joe Biden, which will destroy the America we know?
And with that, people are going to ask this question. You're talking about going around the country. One of the absolute things that are the lightning in a bottle for President Trump is getting in front of people firsthand. That has been hamstrung with this pandemic. How do you get around that? You had the bus tour. Are you going to do more virtual things? What's going to go on with the campaign?
Absolutely. Definitely more virtual events. The president has done tele-rallies. He's done virtual fundraisers. You're going to see a lot more of those. And as the numbers come in, as the data comes in, as the science comes in, we may be doing rallies later on. But for right now, the campaign has done a phenomenal job at switching to an all-virtual event. Many of us will be out on the road coming to a city near you. And we'll just have to, time will tell. We'll just have to see what happens and how these change. And I will tell you this. Donald Trump is the one person that wants to be out there with the people. That is where he's the most comfortable, and he loves being around his supporters. So I can guarantee you, when it's time, you will see him.
All right. Katrina Pearson, senior advisor for the Trump campaign. Thanks for being on with us today, and hopefully we'll get you back on the show soon.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
All right, there it is. And hopefully I answered a few of y'all's questions from the text line, and we can talk about this when we return. Phone number 343-0106, 343-0106. We roll on with Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Tell you what, I am fascinated by this wide-ranging testimony going on today with the House Judiciary Committee questioning Attorney General William Barr. I've got State Senator Chris Elliott joining us at about 1:35, but let's see, we got a few minutes here. Let's do this. Let's go to that feed live from Washington now, and should be Attorney General Barr speaking as of now.
Two churches.
That was on an injunction.
Did you accept that, or you don't accept it? Well, now, we'll talk about it later. Mr. Barr, with no vaccine, no treatment, no cure in sight, you work to disarm the states of the only weapon we have against this disease, public health measures. And now we pay the price of this policy in overrun intensive care units and morgues, a shortage of coffins and refrigerated trucks, and an out-of-control pandemic, which makes us a global pariah state whose citizens cannot enter dozens of foreign countries, including Canada. Do you know what Dr. Fauci was saying at the same time that you were moving to take down those public health orders? Here's what Dr. Fauci was warning us about 3 months ago about the premature abandonment of health orders. If only you had listened. He said, I feel if that occurs, there is a real risk you will trigger an outbreak and you may not be able to control it, which in fact paradoxically—
We were not taking down public health orders.
Time.
We were making narrow—
The gentleman's time is
we were calling attention
Chair,
to the fact—
will you restore my time because this witness is speaking over my time?
You went over time. Let the witness respond.
He's trying to—
Gentleman's time is expired. Who seeks recognition?
Mr. Chairman.
Gentleman's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have a governor in Virginia who is engaged in overreach, particularly regarding the civil rights of Virginians and their expression of their religious faith. So I want to give the Attorney General the opportunity to respond to the
Right.
Gentleman from Maryland.
We adopted a very narrow approach of calling to the attention, usually by letter, not by lawsuit, of situations where they were treating religion worse than they were other kinds of organizations and gatherings, and the Constitution requires that it be treated the same. And we were calling those to the attention of the governors, and most of the governors that we called attention to voluntarily changed their own orders. There were a few occasions where we pointed out anomalies in the regulation, differential regulation of business, and again, mostly they were voluntarily changed by the governors. So this was not a wholesale attack on stay-at-home orders. It was just that these are very broad powers that have been ceded, you know, basically telling everyone to stay at home and only work if you're an essential business and so forth. And therefore, someone has to keep an eye on that and make sure there's no overreach. And as time went by, there were times where, you know, that you had these crazy rules in effect that were overly burdensome and raised constitutional problems.
I want to thank you for raising those points early, and particularly with regard to Virginia and the church out on the Eastern Shore. I want to thank you also for being here and for returning to lead the Department of Justice and right the ship and root out the rank partisanship and bias that had corrupted the administration of justice for many years. The Democrats allege that Attorney General Barr has politicized the Justice Department, doing the personal bidding of President Trump, but it's not only unfounded, it's especially hypocritical in light of the politicization that occurred during the Obama-Biden administration and led by President Obama's self-described wingman, Attorney General Eric Holder. The Obama-Biden Justice Department investigated journalists, shut out career prosecutors, and flouted congressional oversight. I want to ask, particularly, even after President Trump assumed office, FBI lawyers exhibited bias against Trump while working for both Mueller and the FBI's Russia investigation, and the Inspector General couldn't rule out political animus against candidate Trump as influencing FBI abuse, correct?
That's my understanding.
The Inspector General found that an FBI lawyer altered evidence to support a FISA application to surveil Carter Page and criminally referred this lawyer to Durham for federal prosecution. The same lawyer who also worked on the investigations into Clinton's misuse of classified information and Russia collusion expressed bias against President Trump. And the Inspector General testified back in December that he can't rule out bias. Mr. Attorney General, I'd ask, what would the consequences be to one of your Justice Department lawyers if they doctored underlying documents so they could support evidence submitted to a federal court?
You know, in the abstract, talking generally, that lawyer would be fired.
Would they likely be disbarred as well?
Yes.
And isn't it true that the IG found that an FBI lawyer doctored an email to support probable cause against candidate Trump's campaign aide?
I think that's right.
And the same FBI lawyer worked on the Russia investigation targeting candidate Trump's campaign and was on the special counsel Mueller team investigating President Trump, correct?
I'm not sure about that.
And while working on those investigations, the Inspector General found several texts showing that animus, correct?
On that particular lawyer? I believe so.
Yes.
I can't remember the time frame of the text, but I know there were other texts.
I'm going to talk to you about the unmasking that occurred where Mr. Grinnell released a list of 39 officials who submitted a request to unmask the identity of General Flynn from November 8th, 2016 to January 31st, 2017. 49 requests were submitted. Is that a normal number of requests for unmasking?
I mean, historically, that seems to be a high number, and the other question you have to ask is why was this after the election?
And seven Treasury officials, including Secretary of the Treasury Jacob Lew, Deputy Secretary Sarah Raskin. Is that a normal occurrence?
You know, there are times where high-level officials can do it. I don't know enough about the specifics.
I'm going to yield the remainder of my time to Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Attorney General, what's more important, going to church or going to a protest?
It depends on the individual.
Both covered under the First Amendment, right?
Right.
Yeah, what's more important, going to work or going to a protest?
Again, it depends on the individual. You know, we're all free. We can all make our choices.
I'm talking about government limits on those activities. What's more important, government putting limits on protesting or government's putting limit on attending church?
Are they both First Amendment?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And we should treat them the same, shouldn't we?
Right.
Gentleman's time has expired. Ms. Jayapal.
Mr. Barr, on June 1st, there were protests against the murder of George Floyd and police brutality in Lafayette Park. Let us not be distracted by you or my GOP colleagues as to what these powerful and massive protests were actually about. They were about the persistent killing of black bodies by law enforcement, and finally, an awakening in America of the conscience of our country. And yet, your response, Mr. Barr, was to direct federal officers to close in on the protesters and to use shields offensively as weapons, tear gas, pepper balls, irritants, explosive devices, batons, and horses to clear the area just so the president could get a photo.
And I bet you, as we go to the news break, he's going to respond the same way he did, the attorney general did in his opening statements. That's just a guess on that. I do like his response when questioned what's more important, going to a protest or going to church. I know a lot of people would say, well, church. I like the attorney general who says they're equal. It just depends on the person. Nice thing to hear. All right. Coming right back, State Senator Chris Elliott joins us right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here on this Tuesday. And like I told you, this I imagine the House Judiciary Committee questioning of Attorney General Barr will still be going on when you get home. So I gave you a little primer last hour. It'll still be going on probably at dinner time tonight. And then we'll talk about it more coming up tomorrow morning on Mobile Mornings. We'll check in right now with State Senator Chris Elliott joining us. And thanks for your time. Thanks for being on.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Last time we were talking, you were in Montgomery. We're talking about some the road projects never sleep, right?
That is correct. It is a constant battle to make sure we get our share of road money back here in coastal Alabama. We sure raise a good portion of it through a bunch of different funding sources. And, of course, on any given day during the summer, we have, about 100,000 extra people enjoying our county. And this summer has been no exception to that.
So in that process of trying to make sure, I mean, there's one part of that is legislative. It's bills you've brought into the Senate, debates that have happened there. But there's a day in and day out process as well, right? I mean, a committee process where you're representing for 32, representing for Baldwin County, representing for the roads there.
Well, that's correct. And it's also, frankly, about your relationships with your colleagues and the committees that you're able to position yourself on in order to effectively advocate for your particular district. For instance, the lieutenant governor, who is a good friend and colleague of mine, has appointed me to the Joint Transportation Committee. That is the committee that is essentially directing state road projects, so road projects across the state, everything from resurfacing to different MPO projects and RPO projects across the state. That's Metropolitan Planning Organization and Regional Planning Organization. Sorry for the jargon there. But trying to make sure that we get those dollars to the right spot all the way across the state. So while it may not be a particular piece of legislation one way or the other, a lot of that behind-the-scenes work has to happen in order to get that plan together, the state transportation spending plan, and that's where, if you will, the sausage gets made.
Looking at the sausage process here, it looks like the sausage is going to have to sit if the recipe is going to be changed. To stay with a strange analogy, if the recipe is going to be changed, it's going to have to wait until 2021, right? I mean, it's I ask you this every time, but it's my due diligence. Still no word on a special. Not going to happen. What do you think?
Still no word on a special. You know, the Constitution vests the governor with the exclusive ability to call the legislature back into session to deal with pressing issues that simply cannot wait until the Constitution requires that the legislature meet. We're talking about early March, very, very late February, early March of next year. I think that there are a more pressing issues than there have been in the recent past that need to be addressed. Everything from a prison crisis to economic development issues to COVID to school funding issues. You can just imagine, what all is at stake right now that we need to be worried about and we need to be paying attention to.
Well, I wonder about that. Last time you were on with us, we were talking about schools and getting kids back in schools. But you got school districts in the state, some out there saying that, you know what, they're not, you know, they're, I mean, look right here for Mobile, talking about going back, but at a limited way. You've got other school systems saying they're full on, others that are questioning whether they're going to go back till way later in the year. And while that falls under Dr. Eric Mackey, it seems like funding for that or questions about rural broadband or broadband initiatives, that would all be part of what the legislative branch would get into. I mean, if we're talking about extra money beyond the CARES Act money to be applied, that's y'all's job.
Well, and that is certainly what I thought as well, too, and why I took such a strong stance on the budget bills that were passed. The supplemental for this year in particular, and you will remember that discussion towards the end of the session where the government sent back, or the governor sent back over an executive amendment that gave essentially appropriations authority for $1.8 billion exclusively to the governor. So I think that money should have gone through an appropriations process in the legislature so that the legislature could figure out the best way to spend that money, whether it's for preparing our schools to get back in session, make sure our teachers have the protections that they need and our kids have the protections they need. Setting those types of priorities, which is the legislature's primary job, to appropriate funding, but that's not what the governor saw fit, and unfortunately the rest of my legislative colleagues went along with that executive amendment. I was the lone legislator to vote against it.
You know, and if just joining us, talk to State Senator Chris Elliott. With that discussion of the CARES Act money, there's also this timeline of December 28th. I know a lot of discussion going on in Washington right now. It seems like, and I know this is a discussion for Washington, not Montgomery, but I'd like to get your take on it. As they're ready to have more tranches of money put in and, you know, more programs out there, it seems like the more fiscally prudent way to do this would be to let states have more time to allocate the money that's been given to them before giving anybody anything, giving them any more money, right? Instead of going directly, I mean, we're talking about, I think, $105 billion in this for schools, but in the new whatever the HEALS Act, which I think is ripe for satire here, but the HEAL Act, I think they could hold back the $105 billion and tell the states, hey, you have a little bit more time to use the money you already have. I mean, that it seems like we're doubling up on something that we don't need to.
Well, you're absolutely right on a number of different issues, one of which is that the governor is going to have a very hard time spending this money in the amount of time allotted by the federal act. So, and that was one of my concerns early on, just from a staffing standpoint alone, the ability to evaluate these applications and look at different programs that needed to happen. Again, that's something that I think the legislature could have been helpful with if she had, relinquished some of that control. She didn't see fit to do that. But you're absolutely right, too, about the additional money that Washington is considering right now. Listen, as a state legislator and a small businessman, there's part of me that is you know, likes the idea of, hey, that free money. But we have got to understand it's not free money. It's deficit spending. And the Republican Party is supposed to be made up of fiscal conservatives, and I am incredibly concerned about the federal government handing out billions and trillions of dollars that we haven't even figured out a use for yet. And that to me is a little troubling and something that I am looking forward to the new Congress addressing.
Yeah, and there is part of that. It's this ability to subjugate your personal, maybe what might be good short term for you, for what's good for the republic. Yeah, I'm in a position in the business of media and advertising that I could see a new tranche of money coming out with a set of ads that are promoting rural broadband, this, that, or the other, that would be to benefit in the short term our business, but. This is going on everywhere, and we can, like, there's no end to this. Like, there's never going to be, the check's never going to arrive at the table there. And it scares me because it will. At some point, it will.
These chickens will come home to roost. I mean, there is no question about it. We are going to wake up one day and go, how did we get here? And more importantly, what did we get from it? And that's what I think is the real question. You know, we could have embarked on a spending plan that would have rejuvenated our infrastructure, would have you know, done things like build an I-10 bridge or other much-needed road projects across the country. Instead, we're handing it out. Just here you go. And my problem with that is, look, there's some debt that's good debt, but gosh, debt just for the sake of handing out money, I'm just not sure. That's the right way to go, and I think we're going to probably regret this type of deficit spending down the road.
I mean, I get that, okay, so they had to react, and some of the programs, PPP, I think was a good program. I think listening to this audience, the $1,200 stimulus payments mean a lot to folks out there. You know, that are negotiating the tough times and a tough economy. But yeah, you look at something like the situation with the CARES Act, we have the money. The money has been allocated to Alabama. Give us time to use it properly before sending more money that we can't get used in time. I don't know why that's not getting through to Washington.
Well, I think that you probably in the first part of your show are seeing exactly why that is, and that's because Washington is no longer interested in actually working. It's interested in headlines, it's interested in looking good, and it's interested in fighting with each other. And that's one of the reasons you will see me stay in state politics and not go to Washington, D.C. ever.
I got some questions coming in on the text line. This one's good. From Ben in Point Clear, he said, question for Mr. Elliott. I have a road in Wilcox County that's not been resurfaced in my lifetime. I just turned 38. Where do I start to get on a list? It's in rough shape, and the county officials couldn't care less about it.
Well, if it's a county road, and you know, I've got some history as a county commissioner as well as a state legislator, but if it's a county road, then you need to see your county commissioner for that, you know, that maintenance and that paving. And we, you know, I've certainly dealt with plenty of those throughout my career as a county commissioner, and they will have to figure out their budget priorities and when and where that falls within their either resurfacing plan or their road paving plan. I'll also say this too, you know, there are plenty of roads around this state, and we used to have a lot more of them in Baldwin County than we do now, that simply don't have the traffic volume on them to need to be paved. If you've got 10 cars going down a road a day, you know, a dirt road is perfectly fine in rural parts of counties. Now, I'm not suggesting that's what's happening here, but there are some instances that I've run into in the past where I've said, look, a dirt road is all this really warrants.
Right, so there is a formula, so to speak, on this, right, for traffic, for amount of use.
Yeah, there was in Baldwin County. I don't know what the Wilcox County Commission has set up or not, but there is funding both from the state and through the county commission's revenue sources to improve and maintain roadways throughout Wilcox County.
All right, when we come back from the break, more with State Senator Chris Elliott. The question that came up last time we were talking about those stimulus checks and would the state be coming after tax dollars on that? We're going to talk about that with the senator. And also a tribute I saw from the senator on Facebook earlier this week I want to talk about with him when we return.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, here we go. 152 FM Talk 106.5. Midday Mobile on this Tuesday, and we'll check back in with staff meteorologist Dr. Bill Williams. But thunderstorms, rain showers, that's prescription again today. Looks like tomorrow as well, but drying out by the end of the week. But more from Dr. Bill coming up in just a little bit, plus the Paul Feinbaum Show on the way shortly. Continue our conversation with State Senator Chris Elliott. And when we talked last time we talked, somebody had come in with a question about getting taxed on the stimulus money, $1,200 for an individual, $2,400 for a couple, $500 per additional child on that. And I remember the first set of stimulus checks, there was not a state tax penalty on it that I knew of. Has that changed, or what's going on with that?
There is still, unfortunately, one that may affect, unless we can pass legislation that I proposed last session, that will impact the $1,200 you already got in your pocket. That's the frustrating thing, is that we left town, again, largely at the governor's direction and the speaker's direction, without passing bills other than budget bills. It's one of the reasons I was so hopeful for a special session, was to get important legislation like that passed. I have got it teed up and sitting on my desk and ready to go to file in a special session, or certainly file next session and make retroactive. The bigger concern, Sean, is that the PPP loans that you mentioned before, that are forgivable loans, if forgiven, are considered income and would accordingly be taxed by the State Department of Revenue. And that was the second part of my bill, was making sure that this stimulus money that we're trying to inject back into the economy is not then subsequently taxed by the state.
Business owners took the PPP money to keep people employed, keep them off the unemployment rolls, keep people working, and the incentive to do that was the fact that, hey, there was going to be this loan, and this loan, the amount used for keeping people employed and a few other things would be without tax penalty. But maybe that was just federal, you're saying. So right now, as it stands, business owners could be taxed on that income from the federal government.
That's correct. And individuals
Holy
can be
cow.
Taxed on their $1,200 or $2,400. And listen, this is why, in my opinion, it's important to have a legislator that's a small business owner that understands this kind of stuff, that when it pops up is looking at it going, hold on just a second, there's probably some tax liability associated with this, and we need to make sure that doesn't hit our businesses and hit the individuals again. So it's something I'm watching. It's a bill that the Alabama Policy Institute has endorsed and wrote an opinion piece on here recently that we absolutely need to get passed, and one that I will be pushing for as soon as we get back to session.
So, okay, so it could be, I mean, I'm trying to think of tax deadlines. I mean, because from you and others, it sounds like the chances of having a special session, they're not good. So you get back in regular session, and you think this is something y'all could get after right away, maybe, and make sure that that's done before tax time.
Correct. That would be the goal, is to get straight on it at the end of February, beginning of March, get that done, and over to the governor for signature, so that that's handled prior to the April tax filing deadline.
All right, before we wrap up, I want to talk about what you posted up on your Facebook page the other day, and I was thinking I had gotten a note about the passing of Robert Eddington. Pat Eddington, one-time representative here in the state of Alabama, and pretty pivotal also in the USS Alabama Commission. Talk about Robert Eddington.
You know, Robert was just a patriot from a different party, and I didn't agree with him on a lot of things. But, you know, you look back on his service to his country in Korea, his service to his community when he got home, both as a lawyer, as a state representative, as a state senator, and one-time U.S. Senate candidate, his work on the battleship commission, as you correctly point out, his pivotal role in establishing a little institution called the University of South Alabama through legislation that he passed. I mean, you talk about a life well lived, and an opportunity to be nostalgic about times where things just weren't as polarized as they are right now. You know, I always saw Robert at every Austell christening there ever was. He was there as a former Navy commander and just a stalwart of what was happening there at Austell. Just a great guy, and really from an era that, frankly, I think a lot of us wish we could go back to, something much less polarized and much more about actually getting things done for the people. I think that time's probably gone with Robert, but he and Pat, his bride, remain in our thoughts and prayers, and just a life well lived and worth taking the time to talk about. And I appreciate you doing so.
Hey, well said, and I appreciate you posting that up. Chris Elliott, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Sean.
All right, State Senator Chris Elliott. And, yeah, if you'll go check out his post on Facebook under Senator Chris Elliott, you'll see what he wrote about Robert Eddington. And it was touching and well said. All right, Pine Bomb is next.